Ah, well, Tip, it's a comely spot to rest your bones, eh? Or shall we walk a wee bit further?
The dog looked at her master and wagged her tail.
Oh, quite right, quite right. We've come far enough for today. No sense getting a much from the road. Quite right ye are.
Pim the Tinker began shaking off his burdens, loosening the packs and sacks and strings of pots, pans, and tools, all of which he carried with him on his back. But one package he placed carefully on the ground, propping it upright against a stone. Pim's bright eyes glittered with glee, and he rubbed his hands with delight.
Ah! Now, Tipper, some firewood, just the thing, eh? Just that thing. It'll be darkening soon. First fetch the wood and the fire will follow, eh? Quite right.
In no time, the little tinker and his dog were curled before a cozy fire, drinking their soup, watching the stars come out in the sky as night settled peacefully over the land. Every now and then, the man stole a look toward the slender, rag-wrapped package that he had propped up against the stone.
Oh, would you see that, Tip? There's our fortune.
When they had drunk their broth and sopped the last of it with hunks of dry black bread, the tinker reached for the bundle and laid it across his knees.
Oh, looky, Tip. Old Pim has found our fortune, yes he has. I told ye he would, I told ye. Looky, look.
Pim carefully pulled the rags away with trembling fingers. And there, revealed in the flickering firelight, was a great sword, long and thin, tapering almost imperceptibly along its smooth, flawless length to a deadly point. The grip and hilt shone in the firelight as if cut from gemstone.
Such a beauty, this son. This is no common blade, no, sir. Pim can tell he can. I know a wee bit about swords, you see. This one's the royal blade, if ever I saw one. Yes, it is!
Pim's fingers traced the fine markings along the blade, hardly daring to touch it. His eyes filled with wonder at the sight. The big black dog watched her master, head on paws, listening to the sound of his voice.
Oh, yes! This blade's a beauty never meant for common hand. Someone give a fortune for this. A fortune, you see! As much as I were to ask, why, Tip, we uns have us enough to buy a little wagon. Oh, yes! And another sharpening stone, a round un. With a treadle foot would be fine. I could sharpen knives and shears and plowshares and anything that needs sharpening. Yes, we could, and Tip. Ye know I could, Tip. Ye know it. Why, we uns would make our own fortune.
The tinker gazed at the sword happily, still not quite believing his good luck. Then a shudder went through him, as he remembered how he had found the sword.
A shame about the body, Tip. Terrible shame about that, but I had nothing to do with it, not a snip. Found him like that, you see. Come upon him in the road. Not long dead, I think. Ye saw him first, didn't ye, Tip? Yes. Why, ye let out that growl, I knew something was amiss, didn't I? Yes. You don't growl without cause, and that were cause enough indeed. A man dead in the road. Terrible thing. Head near cut off. And this sword just lying in the dust beside him.
Pim took the sword in his hand and felt its quick strength. His face glowed with admiration.
Old Pim knows a crafter when he sees it, yes, sir. Someone will give good gold to get this back, much as I were to ask. Enough gold for a wagon and a sharpening stone.
A thought occurred to him. What if the one dead in the road was the owner? Who would give the gold then? He frowned and turned the blade in the firelight, shaking his head.
Nah. That had never owned a blade like this, no, sir. No one ever did, but maybe a king.
Another thought struck him, and his eyes grew round in fright.
But what if they think I stole it? What if they think it was old Pim killed that man and took his sword? No, I'd never kill a man nor take his blade. Old Pim's a peaceable fella. Everyone knows he is. 'Twas in the road. I found it there. How it got there, I cannot say. Oh, but I must be careful now. Oh, yes. Very careful. There's some as would steal away this from an old poor tinker. Then poor old Pym would lose his fortune.
Pym stared woefully at his prize, and then his face brightened once more.
We must hide it, Tip. That's what we uns'll do. We'll hide it. Wrap it up in rags and hide it somewhere so not a body can find it. We uns'll keep our eyes and ears open, look up and listen, that's right, and see what we can learn about this here sword. Yes, we uns must hide it well, Tip, and so we will.
Deep in the forest, night had become a black curtain that cut off all sight, save the occasional glimpse of the stars overhead through the interweaving branches. The moon had not yet risen, so the forest byways were difficult to follow. Prince Garin, shuffling with his head down, exhausted by his long ordeal, longed to stretch out beneath a tree to rest and let sleep steal from him the memory of this evil day.
We will stop here to rest. We should have put them off the trail by now. We will not be found. But we must be careful not to be seen.
The men were too tired to speak. They stood wearily on their feet and looked about them, wondering dully how the old man leading them found the strength to keep going.
Height is what keeps him afoot. Look at him. Old as he is, and still spry as ever. He'd walk all night.
He might, but I cannot.
You there! Stop muttering and see to our prisoner. You will take turns guarding him. Remember, your heads are forfeit if he escapes.
Prince Garin heard only part of what was said. The next thing he knew, he was being half-dragged, half-shoved to a nearby tree, to be bound there with a cord for the night.
There now. Be good and give us no trouble, young sire. We do not wish to harm you, but you must not try to get away. That could be very painful indeed.
Garin only looked sleepily at the man and lay back against the tree. In a moment, he was sound asleep.
Look at him. Not a care in the world.
He is a prince, by Ariel. No one would dare lift a hand against him.
Keep your voice down. Don't let Longbeard hear you.
Longbeard. There's a cold one. He is trouble, I said so from the start. Look what has happened. One dead, the prince kidnapped. This could bring down the temple.
Shh! He watches us. Remember, we're trying to save the temple.
This business is no good. No good at all.
The man settled himself to sleep. The other sat down on a rock, chin in hand, to wait his watch. He glanced around at the others, already sleeping. The guard rubbed his neck and shook his head as he felt the weariness engulf him.
Yes, Ervis is right. It's a bad business. It could well bring the temple tumbling down about our ears. I'm not to blame. I only do what I'm told. The High Priest himself ordered it. What choice did I have?
The guard pulled his cloak around him and folded his arms over his chest. His head nodded. And soon, he was sleeping like all the rest. Quentin's eyes burnt and his back ached. He had been in the saddle all day and was not accustomed to it. He could feel his sore muscles stiffening as the chill of night seeped into his bones. Ignoring his body's plea to stop and rest, he pulled his short cloak more tightly around him and plodded on. The trail had grown too dark to see hours ago, but still he traveled on, hoping by some miracle that he would stumble across the kidnappers. Knowing that his son was still out there somewhere in the dark, frightened, held prisoner, that thought alone kept him going. Heartsick, numb with misery and despair, Quentin wanted only to throw himself to the ground to weep at his misfortune. A few short hours ago, he had walked in the light, his realm secure, the future a bright promise. Now, there was only darkness. In the space of half a day, he had lost his son, his trusted friend, and worst of all, the favor of the Most High. His mind reeled at the enormity of his trouble. His heart ached with sorrow,
His body throbbed with grief and exhaustion. How was it possible? How could it happen so quickly? Why was there no warning, no hint at what was to befall him? He could only shake his head in mute wonder. For an instant, he imagined that all he need do was turn Blazer back toward home and all would be well once more. Upon reaching Ascalon, he would find Derwin alive and the prince safe in his bed. His sword would be found in his chambers, lying across its hangers below the royal device, the flame intact, the god still with him. But it was a dream, and the grim reality remained unchanged. Hoping against hope, Quentin determined that somehow he would make everything right again. He could do it. He was the Dragon King. He would make it right.
Onward, Blazer. Must go onward.
Head down, the horse ambled on.
They are here, my lady. They have come.
The maid approached quietly, lest she disturb her queen's vigil.
What? Quentin is back. He has returned.
Bria jumped up, a brief light leaping to her green eyes. Then she saw the look the maid gave her, and the light dimmed.
Oh. No, the king has not returned, but Lords Thedo and Ronsard are here. You asked me to fetch you as soon as they came. They are waiting in the hall.
Queen Bria left at once and went down to meet her old friends.
My lady!
Thedo and Ronsard were the only ones in the great room.
How lovely you look!
Just as I remember your mother. How is Alinia?
Thedo, Ronsard, I am glad you are here at last. Forgive me for pulling you from your warm beds at this early hour. My mother is well. I am certain she will wish to receive you soon, but I would speak to you first.
Thedo saw the dark shadows behind her smile, and knew that the queen had summoned them on a matter of great urgency.
Perhaps this is not the place to discuss important things. A more private chamber would be better.
Yes, follow me.
Bria led them out of the hall and along the white corridor to a small room, a council room that contained a heavy table with bankers on either side, and a grouping of high-backed chairs in a further corner. The three entered and took their seats facing one another.
Now then, what has happened?
Bria looked from one to the other of the two knights, men she had known all her life, trusted friends of her parents. They had served the Dragon King's house numerous times and stood always ready to serve again. Their stalwart devotion and her own need overwhelmed her, and she broke down and cried.
I hardly know where to begin.
The two glanced at one another helplessly, both feeling the depths of her sorrow.
The words come hard, good sirs. Derwin is dead.
By the gods, no. Say not so.
And my son has been taken.
When did this happen, and how was it accomplished?
Thedo's tone helped Bria to calm herself.
Yesterday, during the hunt. The prince was to ride in the hunt. He was so proud it was his first. Toli rode with him. Quentin and Derwin went along, but were to return to join the festival after leading the hunt. The king was a long time returning. We thought he had taken up the hunt as well. Then Toli came, and he told us what had happened. Oh. They were attacked and fought off their assailants. Toli followed, but lost the trail. When he rejoined Derwin and Garin, Derwin was dead and the prince gone. Quentin sent Toli for help. That was yesterday. I have not seen them since.
Who would dare such a thing? This is an outrage!
We must organize a search at once. Though I will be frank, too much time has passed already. If the kidnappers were on horseback, they could have ridden far.
Still, if ransom is their game, they may not have gone far at all. Indeed, they may be close at hand.
Yes, yes. There is something in what you say, but we must hurry in any case. My lady, in the absence of the king, will you give us the authority to command a body of knights?
Anything you require.
Good. I know those men who served under me. We can start there.
Go, rouse them out. And see that they are outfitted for the trail. I will follow directly.
Ronsard stood and gave a little bow to the queen.
Take courage, my lady. We will find the boy.
Is there anything else you can tell us?
I know so little. No, I have told you all I know. Toli could tell you more, but he is gone. Lord Bossett might know something.
Bria reached out and took Thedo's hand.
Find him, good friend. Save my child as once you saved my father.
Thedo pressed her hand, and she felt his confidence flowing into her in that touch.
One way or another, we will find them. I know it. I do not know how long it may take, but we will rescue him unharmed. You may believe it. You must believe it.
I do believe, and I pray that it is so.
Yes, pray. Your mother has taught me the power of women's prayers. The god, I think, does listen most intently to a woman's heart.
Then I think he has heard mine through the night. Oh, Thedo, if anything happens to him, I do not think...
We will bring him back hale and whole. You will see. I must go now and find Lord Bossett. The sooner we make a start, the better.
Yes, go. And Thedo, thank you for coming. You have no idea what it means to me.
Would that it were a happier time, my lady.
In the last hours of the night, when all the earth was still and waiting for the new day, Quentin had stopped along the road to rest and had fallen asleep beneath a larch tree, his cloak spread over him. Sleep offered no release or comfort. Fitful, troubled was his rest, broken by dreams of futile chases and violent clashes with an unseen enemy. There descended upon him a helpless, hopeless feeling of dread and loss, which pierced his heart as cruelly as any poisoned dagger, and though he slept, he ached with the pain. He awoke more wrung out than when he lay down, and rose wearily, stiff from his hard bed among the roots of the tree. In the raw red light of dawn, Quentin rubbed his burning eyes and set about saddling Blazer once more.
Quentin!
The king turned his eyes to the shout and peered into the dimness of the forest trail. The sun was not yet fully up, and the shadow still lay heavy along the road, but he perceived the forms of riders approaching some way off. Quentin waited, then recognized Tolly riding toward him out of the gloom.
Sire, at last we have found you!
Have you seen anything?
No, my lord, nothing. That is, except the body of an unfortunate lying in the road.
Tolly's eyes examined his master carefully.
Yes.
Quentin turned away and put his foot into the stirrup.
I saw him too.
Tolly did not pursue the matter further, thinking it better to leave it for now.
What would you have us do, Kenta?
Find my son!
Tolly wisely ignored the remark.
We should return to the castle for more men. We could cover more ground that way. We need fresh horses and supplies.
Do what you will. I will continue the search alone.
Where will you go?
South.
Why south? They could easily have turned off the trail anywhere. In the night, we would have missed the track.
What else am I to do? I have no better choice.
Return with us to Escalon. We will rest and ready ourselves for a proper search. We can send messengers out to all the towns and villages to watch for the brigands. We can...
My son has been taken, Tolly! I will not return until he is found. I cannot return until he is safe.
Tolly searched the face of the one he knew so well, and yet at this moment seemed not to know at all.
Derwin's blood is on your head, as is my son's, if anything happens to him. They would be safe now if you had not left them alone. You are to blame for this. It is your fault!
Speechless, Tolly stared at his master and friend. Never had Quentin raised his voice toward him. Never had he shown anger toward him.
I am sorry. Sorry.
Find my son! Find him, or never let me set eyes on you again!
With that, the Dragon King slashed the reins across his stallion's neck and wheeled him around. Quentin glared at Tolly.
Find him. Just find him.
Tolly stood in the road and watched his king ride away. He watched until a bend in the road took him from sight. Then he turned toward Ascalon. No one spoke. There was nothing to say. Nimrud sat brooding on a rock, hunched like a bent old root, twisted with age and warped by the dark forces within him. He was waiting for nightfall to undertake the final leg of their journey, for they had reached the eastern edge of the forest and the rest of his way to the temple lay through open ground. He did not want to risk traveling by day, so they waited restlessly. Prince Garen, his young mind alert to all around him, was confident he would not be harmed. And since he appeared in no immediate danger, escape could wait for the right opportunity, if he was not rescued first. He also saw quite plainly that his abductors had little spirit for the task they were about.
But the old one, the one with the wild white hair and the face as lined and creased as worn leather, he was one to watch out for. Who was he? What did he want? And where were they taking him? These questions occupied the young captive as he sat on the ground beneath the tree, two guards with him at all times. Garen shifted uneasily, trying to loosen the bonds on his arms. One of the guards eyed him suspiciously, glared, but didn't say anything.
My father comes for me. You will be very sorry. I hope he comes soon. I'm going to miss the rest of the hunt otherwise.
There was no doubt in the young prince's mind that the king would come for him, would rescue him. All he had to do was wait. Nimrud jumped up.
We are found. Draw your weapons.
What? No! Wait!
You!
The man was one of the two left behind to guard their escape.
I was not followed. Put away your swords.
You better not have been followed, or I will feed you piecemeal to the birds. Where is your friend?
Dead.
The man cast a terrified look behind him, as if expecting his own death to come charging out of the woods at any moment.
How?
He found us on the road. He guessed all.
Who found you?
The king! He knew all about us!
Bah, you said too much!
No, by all the gods, I swear it! We told him nothing. He knew, I don't know how he knew, but he did! We did not have a chance!
How many were with him?
His Majesty the King was alone. I hid in the bushes in case we were forced to attack him.
And?
Carlin pretended to be a pilgrim, but the king knew different. We tried to put him off, but...
You were two against one. What happened?
That sword of his, the shining one. No man, no army is a match for that. You should have seen it flash. The flames, it blinded us, and I threw my hands over my eyes. When I looked, Carlin was dead. That sword.
Yes, I see. You did right to come here with the news, yes. But tell me more concerning that sword. The king's sword. What did you call it?
The shining one. Everyone knows about it.
It is enchanted, is it? How so? I do not seem to recall anything about an enchanted sword. But then, I have been long away from Menzendor. Tell me more about it.
Eagerly, the men told Nimrud about Jalakir, the king's wonderful sword. About its burning brightness, about the magic mines wherein it was forged, about its strange and terrible powers. They told about how Quentin, still a young man, had come riding out of the mountains with a sword, and by his hand alone smashed the invasion of the horrible Nin, and turned certain defeat into resounding victory when the Shining One quenched the fire of the Wolf Star. Legends concerning the enchanted sword and the king who wielded it had already grown large in the land and increased with every passing year. It was possessed of a holy power, they said. It was enchanted by a god, the one called Most High. Its flame was the symbol of the god's presence with the king, and more. Nimrud listened patiently to the various stories about the sword, letting the temple guards tell him what they knew. All the time, the old sorcerer was thinking to himself.
Yes, this enchanted sword is just the thing. What you say is very interesting, yes, very interesting. Do you have anything else to tell me?
Yes. The king said Derwin, the one called the Hermit, was dead.
Oh, how is that?
I don't know.
You killed Derwin?
No one meant to kill him, sir. It was an accident. He was in the way. We had to stop him to get the prince.
Nimrud nodded at those around him approvingly.
Yes, accidents happen. It could not be helped. You must tell me these things in the future. I must know everything. It does not do to withhold information from me.
We thought you would be angry.
Angry? Why should I be angry? Am I unreasonable? No. You will find I am quite easy to get along with if you but tell me at once. I can be quite reasonable. Now, get some rest, all of you. We have far to go tonight. I want to be at the High Temple by first light tomorrow.
all settled down to rest for their nocturnal journey. Prince Garen, too, rolled up into a ball, though he did not feel like sleeping. He did so to hide his tears from those around him. He did not want his captors to see him crying for his friend Durwin. At midday, Tolly and the knights with him reached Ascalon. Upon entering the inner ward yard, they found assembled nearly a score of knights with horses and squires darting here and there with provisions and equipment.
What is this?
Tolly hurried to a cluster of men standing in the center of all this activity. The ring parted as he came near.
Thedo, Ronsard!
We were hoping to see you before we rode out. And the king, you have seen him?
Yes, he will not soon be returning.
I see. We must hold council and agree upon a plan in any case. We should not delay.
With the queen's permission, we had hoped to leave at once.
Yes, you must leave soon. I will join you as soon as I have eaten and washed.
I will have food sent to the council chamber.
Ronsard left to arrange it. Those who had ridden through the night with Tolly took their leave also. Thedo walked Tolly a few paces aside to the massive inner curtain where they could talk more freely. The bustle continued in the yard around them. Thedo leaned against the great wall and folded his arms across his chest. His black hair was threaded with much silver, and his eyebrows as well, but the years had not softened his sharp features. If anything, age had made his appearance even more commanding.
There is trouble between you, eh?
Tolly looked across the yard, staring at the activity, seeing nothing. He nodded.
What happened?
My lord blames me for Derwin's death and the loss of his son.
I see. Certainly you know such accusations to be the temper of a distraught and frightened man.
No, it is true. It is my fault. I left him alone. After the first attack, I went after the assailants. I should not have gone. I should never have left the prince for a moment.
You did as you thought best. What man can do more? Derwin knew how to look after himself. He was no stranger to trouble. I'm certain you did the right thing.
Derwin was an old man. Garen, a defenseless child. I failed, I tell you.
No. Think what you are saying. What has happened. It cannot be changed. Derwin's death is not your fault. No one could have known. If you had stayed, it might well have been you struck down to bleed to death.
Better my blood than his.
Never think that. It is not for you to decide such things, my friend. We are all in God's hands. It is he who directs our steps. Derwin knew that as well, no? Better than any of us.
Tolly rubbed his hands over his face. He felt his fatigue descending upon him, covering him like a heavy cloak.
I am tired.
Yes, go wash and change. You shall rest after our council. We will leave and begin the search.
No, I will go with you. I must.
You will need your rest. If I am not wrong, there will be plenty of searching for all of us. Rest while you can. Also, I would have you go with the Queen and the Lady Esme.
The Queen? Esme? Where are they going?
Derwin is to be buried tomorrow, in the forest. I would go, but now that you are here, I think it better that Ronsard and I lead the search.
Oh, I had forgotten about the funeral, yes. Someone should go with them. Very well, I will do as you suggest.
Tolly turned to leave, hesitated, and turned back.
There is something else. The king's scabbard was empty when I found him. The shining one was gone.
Pym, with his gray-muzzled dog beside him, stumped along the road toward Ascalon. As he walked, he thought about one thing and one thing only, the magnificent sword he had hidden that very morning. Wrapped in its covering of rags, he had placed Jalikir in a hole in a great old hazelnut tree whose heart had long ago been burned out by lightning. The ancient tree was hollow, but somehow still alive. He then marked the tree with a little pile of stones and stood a long time looking at it from all directions, so he would remember it when he came back. Then, collecting his tools and wares, he had rattled off through the forest to the road, heading once more for Ascalon. But his mind was uneasy. With every step, he wavered.
Mayhaps I ought never have left it. Mayhaps I should fetch it back. A body might find it back there and steal it from old Pym. Then there'd be no gold and no wagon, no sharpening stone neither. What to do?
At midday, he stopped in a shady nook of hidden boughs to eat a few morsels. He carried a rind of hard cheese with him, which he cut with a knife for himself and Tip. They washed it down with some water and munched an apple from one of his sacks.
Listen there, Tipper. Someone's coming up the road here. Who could it be? Wiggins best set tight and see who it is.
They waited, and soon they could see a whole throng of people traveling south, away from Ascalon. The first of the group passed by, glancing toward the Tinker, but hurrying on. They were followed closely by 20 or more travelers, whole families, men, women, and children. Pym stepped out onto the road.
I'll be vexed, Tip. Where are all these uns going? Ho there, good traveler, ho! Where are ye bound, and what's all the bother?
You've not heard? Where have you been, man? Asleep? The whole world's a ruffle. It's all full of these. The gods are angry.
Wiggins have been on this here road for 2 days. I met not a body, nor none to tell me nothing.
'Tis the prince. Prince Garin. His young lordship's been stolen and carried off away.
Never say it. When did it happen?
Yesterday morning at the hunt. Thieves took him and slew the king's counselor.
Oh.
50 men there were. You seen anyone?
Me? I never did. No, sir. Never ought neither. We hadn't seen 100 men, but neither hand nor hair have we seen till now. They killed the king's minister?
Dead he is. Oh, the gods are wroth with the king for taking up after this new god of his, this Most High. Ooh, they are angry, and they are showing their ire. This'll teach them.
Ah, this be a dark day. A dark day indeed.
Aye.
The man hastened off down the road once more. Pym started on his way again, stopping several succeeding groups to inquire of them also, and all told the same sad story. It was on everyone's lips, and would surely be the topic of conversation for some time, upsetting the festival as it had.
A deed most foul.
Pym walked along, still proceeding toward Ascalon, though all they met were going the other way, back to their villages and towns in the south to spread the word. In a week, there would not be a single man in all Mensendor who did not know what had happened.
Aye, a deed most foul.
Quentin pushed relentlessly onward. Early in the day, he had forsaken the road and begun combing the side trails, first this way and then the other, hoping to chance across some sign that the assassins had passed through. He found nothing, and with every league descended into a torment and anguish deeper than he had ever known. It seemed at times as if his spirit was tearing itself in two, as if his innermost self was being racked and tortured.
Why has this happened to me? Help your servant, Most High. Help me. Why is there no answer? Why do I feel alone? He has left me. God has cast me aside.
That thought alone might have crushed him, but fear for his son and grief for Derwin added their weight until he thought his heart would burst. Still, he kept on, pushing himself, willing himself to go further, stopping only to rest Blazer now and then and to drink. He continued southward, and as the day bent toward evening, he smelled the salt air of the sea in the breeze and knew he must be nearing the coast. At dusk, he rode out of the forest and climbed a sandy bluff overlooking the sea. Gerfallon lay dark and wine-colored in the setting sun. Overhead, a blank of vermilion clouds scudded ashore on the landward wind. Behind them, darker clouds gathered. Tomorrow would see rain. Quentin allowed Blazer to crop the sweet green grass that grew long on the bluff. To the west lay Hinsenby, though he could not see it, and to the east, the Siplith slid darkly to the sea, its waters cool from the melt of snow on the high Fiskills. Ahead, out across the water, lay the hulking mass of the island. Holy Island, it was called, rising dark from the water, mysterious, uninviting. The source of many stories and much speculation from times past remembering. Green with vegetation and dark with ancient forests, the island was uninhabited, though in older times there were those who attempted to make a home there. But these settlements never lasted long, a few years at the most, and then they were gone. Some said the island was the dwelling of some local gods who did not wish to share their home with mortals. Local rumors maintain that the Eerie Island had once been a place of worship for the early inhabitants of Mensendor, the war-loving and bloodlusting Shoth, who practiced their brutish religion of torture and human sacrifice within its cloaked forests, drinking the blood of their victims and eating their flesh. It was widely believed that there were those who still followed the religion of the Shoth, that weird rites still took place from time to time in secret. Voices were heard to emanate from the island's night-cloaked shores, and sometimes the blood-red light of midnight fires could be seen. Holy Island was also purported to be a place of power, lingering from ancient days when the gods themselves walked the earth in full sight of men, when the inexplicable was commonplace. Dreams, disappearances, apparitions, and miracles. Through the gathering dusk, that island seemed to beckon Quentin. Its bumped shape rose from the flat sea like the head and shoulders of a lordly sea creature, regarding the land with infinite patience.
Come, see what is here. Do you feel my power? Do you fear it?
Quentin stirred and walked down the seaward side of the bluff, still staring at the island lying only a short distance out, less than half a league. He found a trail along the face of the dune, leading down to the shore. Without a thought, he followed the trail, weariness guiding his steps. And with each flagging footfall, his strength ebbed. He had not eaten all day, and had rested little. He felt lightheaded and weak, as if he were a husk, hollow and brittle, and light, to be blown by the wind where it willed. Yet he walked down the winding trail to the sea, letting his feet take him, his mind and body drained by exhaustion. The sea wind freshened, and the clouds above darkened by degrees to violet. An evening mist clung to the upper heights of the island, a shroud to discourage prying eyes. High up on the dune behind him, he heard Blazer, but kept his eyes on the island, as if mesmerized by its presence. Quentin walked a little way along the strand, unaware of what he was doing or where he was going. He had no thought now except to walk, to go wherever his feet would take him. He came to a smooth, rounded form on the beach, discernible in the dying light as a dark object against a slightly less dark background. He stumbled toward it, and his mind conjured up an image of the wretch he had cut down on the road. Slowly he approached, trembling at the thought of encountering that corpse again. Drawing near, he stooped toward the thing and put out a hand.
Hair!
Was it an animal of some sort, dead and washed up on the shore? But beneath the shag, he had felt a hardness that was not like flesh, not even dead flesh. The shape of the thing was like no animal he had ever encountered. He put out his hand again and rubbed it along the hard, bristly surface, then pushed the object. It bumped against the rocks. Then he knew what it was. Quentin bent down and grasped the lower edge of the thing and flipped it over. The oxhide boat, constructed of a design that went back 1,000 years, rocked on its keel. Its oar was tied with a leather cord to the crude seat in the center of the craft. Quentin grabbed the bow of the boat and shoved it over the rocks and into the sea. He clambered in while the water splashed over his boots. He took up the oar and began paddling toward the island. A deep sadness welled up from inside him. It had been there all along, but now, as tired as he was, he could no longer keep it down, and it came flooding up like a spring. He looked into the deep blue water all around, so peaceful. How restful it would be to slip over the side of the little boat and drift down and down beyond thought, beyond pain, beyond remembering. But the king kept paddling, and the night gathered its velvet robes around him as the land fell away behind, still outlined by the iron blue of the sky above. In a little while, Quentin felt a scrape along the bottom of the boat, and then a jolt told him that he had reached the shore of Holy Island. Quentin heaved himself out of the boat and pulled it well up on shore, then stalked into the forest that came right down to the water's edge, striking along an ancient trail through the trees and bushes. How long he walked, he did not know or care. His legs moved of a volition all their own. There was no hurry. He had no destination. Inside, his mind, benumbed with fatigue, churned lazily, functioning ever more slowly, offering no light, no insight. His eyes stared straight ahead, but saw nothing. It was dark, too dark to see anything except the branches of the nearest trees. He listened only to his own breathing and his own heartbeat. Quentin began to feel that he too was but a thing of insubstantial vapors, a wraith with no corporeal existence, doomed to roam the world by night, vanishing by dawn's light. A vague, lingering presence consigned to a shadow world where only shades walked, each wrapped in a private torment, alone and uncomforted for all eternity. The moon rose in the trees, a cold, glowing eye that watched unkindly, shedding little light. Weariness draped itself over his shoulders like a leaden garment, awakening in Quentin a dull ache that throbbed through him with every step.
I must rest. I must stop soon and rest. I am tired. So tired.
But he went on, not knowing where. After a time, he came to a place where the trees stopped, and ahead, shining with the moon's silver light, spread a lawn that swept in a gentle downward curve to meet a lake. Where the lawn and water met, there was formed an arcing crescent, a shimmering moon to mirror the heavenly orb. Quentin marched down to the edge of the lake and stopped, staring across the glass-smooth surface. Here and there, the water winked with the reflected light of a star. Quentin looked down into the water and saw only a forlorn and haggard face peering back at him. A willow tree grew near the water. Long, sweeping branches dipped down and limply, lightly brushed the surface of the lake. The leaves on the branches formed teardrops that fell in never-ending cascades into the lake, watering it as a fountain of sorrow. Quentin went to the old willow and slumped down beneath the trailing limbs. It was dry here and dark. He rested his head against the rough, knotted trunk and pulled his cloak more tightly around him. Sleep claimed him then for its own. He didn't feel his eyes closing or mark his passing into sleep's dark dominion. To Quentin, it was all the same. Although the castle sounds had hours ago taken on subdued night voices, and the funeral party would leave early in the morning for the burial site in Pelgrim Forest, Tully was still awake. He lay on his bed, hands clasped behind his head, gazing upward at the flickering shadow of his bedpost on the wall above him. His mind returned once and again to the painful confrontation with Quentin that morning.
You are to blame! It is your fault!
Like a lash that bit into the flesh, the words tortured him, and he could not escape their fierce judgment.
Yes, yes. Esme!
Tully opened the door wider to let her in.
Tully, it is Bria.
Esme backed away, pulling Tully out into the corridor.
What has happened? What is wrong?
She stands out on the bartizan and will not come in. She stares as if transfixed. I do not know what to do or how to move her.
They hurried quietly along the white passage to the royal chambers, their shadows flitting beside them over the rough walls.
How long has she been out there?
When I brought her supper, she was standing there and told me to leave it, and when I came back a little while ago to see her asleep, her bed was unturned and her food untouched.
Tully nodded but said nothing until they reached the royal apartments. Esme opened the door and went in quietly, Tully following. They passed through several rooms and came out onto the balcony, where Bria stood motionless as carved stone, staring out into the moon-drenched night. Tully took one long look and then turned to Esme.
Go and find Alinea. It may be that she can be of help here.
With a nod, Esme left. Tully turned and went out on the bartizan.
My lady, it is very late. We have much to do tomorrow.
The queen did not move or make a sign that she had heard, or even noticed Tully's presence. It was as if she were under a sorcerer's spell and could be touched by nothing of the world around her. Tully reached out a hand and took her arm. It was cool to the touch, and though she did not resist, she also did not move.
My lady, you must rest.
Tully turned at the sound, and Alinea approached, with a shawl over her arm.
Bria, my dear, it is your mother.
Alinea took the shawl and placed it over her daughter's shoulders.
Come away, my darling.
Alinea glanced at Tully and Esme, Tolly stepped aside and motioned for Esme to follow him. The two retreated to an inner chamber. When they were alone, Alenia put her arms around her daughter and held her.
Dear Bria, I can only wonder what you must feel.
A shudder passed through Bria's body.
He is out there, Mother. My little one, my son, my beautiful boy. He is gone. I shall never see him again. I know it. I shall never... Oh, Mother.
Bria buried her face in her hands. Alenia pulled her tightly to her and stroked her auburn tresses. In the chamber beyond, Tolly and Esme turned away, embarrassed. They crept softly to the corridor to wait. The silence between them grew awkward. Neither one could speak, though both knew that someone should. Esme glanced tentatively at Tolly. He looked back. She dropped her eyes. He turned away. At last, the silence became unendurable.
Esme,
Suddenly, Alenia appeared. Her deep green eyes reflected the depths of her sorrow.
She will sleep now, I think. You two must also rest. These next days will be difficult for us all.
Thank you, my lady. I am sorry.
Shh, say no more. I will look in again before morning, but I'm certain she will sleep soundly.
Good night.
Tolly turned away at once. The two women watched him go.
That one bears the full weight of care on his shoulders. I wish Quentin were here. He would know how to deal with him. No one else can give him counsel.
Esme did not speak, but turned mournful eyes toward the queen.
So much hurt in this world. How fragile our happiness. When it is gone, it seems as if it never was and is never to be regained. But all things move under heaven according to the Most High's will. Nothing happens that he does not see.
Where is the comfort in that? Oh, this Most High of yours, I will never understand him.
Ah, Esme, I thought I would never understand either. But Derwin would tell me, understanding comes through faith, not the other way around. I used to puzzle over that endlessly.
What does it mean?
It means that there are many things about the Most High which faith alone can see. I have learned that all the reasons and all the thought and all the world still cannot bring one closer to belief. Belief must come from the heart.
Esme shook her head slowly.
This God is very different from any I know. The others require neither faith nor understanding, but are content with presents and oblations. It is so much simpler.
Yes, the old gods are simpler, but they do not care what happens to men. They do as they will. But the Most High cares very much, more than you can ever know.
That, at least, is something worth believing. Good night, my lady. Thank you for your words. Good night.
Under night's dark veil, the travelers moved with quick stealth. They kept to the road as much as possible, pushing eastward, avoiding the villages along the way, giving them wide berth in order to escape detection. Prince Garen trudged along with his head down, though he remained alert to any possibility of escape. He had overheard one of his guards say that by morning they would reach their destination. If he was going to escape, he reasoned, it would be best to try sooner rather than later. He had thought about little else all day, having grown tired of waiting for someone to come rescue him.
Why don't they come? What can be keeping them? They must be looking for me. They must certainly know where I've gone. Perhaps they cannot find me. Yes, that is it. Oh, this old Longbeard is a crafty one. He has so muddled our trail that no one can find me. Oh, yes, I must escape. Tonight.
It was settled in his mind. As soon as the attention of his guards, one standing at either side of him and another leading his pony, wavered or their grip slackened, he would be off. They could not catch him. He would outrun them once on horseback. That was his plan. Now, he waited for his opportunity. It came when they arrived at a crossroads. One road angled away to the north, toward the small village along the Arvin. The other led on, rising gradually as it proceeded eastward toward the Fiskill Mountains. The town of Naramore lay straight ahead. A little further to the east and north stood the high temple on its plateau, overlooking the valley and all the realm beyond.
We will go around to the south and then to the temple.
But there is a shorter way, to the north!
Yes, shorter, and more prying eyes to see us pass by.
We know a path.
Silence!
Nimrud took a menacing step forward.
We will do as I say. I am your master!
The man stepped backward, tripped, and fell over a stone in the road. The other guards watched him, their attention momentarily diverted. That was all Prince Garen needed. Quick as the flick of a cat's tail, he leapt into the saddle and snatched the reins out of the startled guard's hands. He wheeled Tarki around and started away.
Stop him! Stop him, you fools!
The guards now ringed them in, waving their hands and shouting, hoping to spook the animal. The frightened horse bolted and bucked, tossing his head wildly.
No.
Garen clung to the pony's mane, pressing his legs together, fighting to remain in the saddle. The horse reared, kicking up his hooves at the dancing shapes around him. Then Garen saw an opening. Pulling the reins aside with all his might, he turned his steed toward the break in the ring. The horse saw the opportunity too, and dashed for it instantly.
Impendious!
The next thing Garen knew, the stars and moon were spinning crazily before him. He felt himself falling, sliding, tipping back over the rump of the horse. Then, the ground came up hard. He lay like a sack of grain tumbled into the road, unable to breathe. Rough hands took hold of him, hauled him to his feet, and shook him. Garen peered around dazedly and saw Tarki bounding away riderless down the road, two guards scurrying after him. Had there been a flash of light? A noise? What was it that had so suddenly appeared in his path? What caused the horse to rear and throw him? He remembered seeing the old man raise his hand high above his head. Then the earth and sky changed places. By what force or power, the boy didn't know. Blazing violet balls of light still bobbed before his eyes. He shook his head, but they remained, fading away only slowly.
The youngster has spirit, but it must be bent to our purposes. Young sir, if you wish to remain alive and whole, you will abandon any further notions of escape.
Nimrud leaned close, his vile breath hot in the prince's face.
Otherwise, when they come for you, they will find nothing worth the ransom.
That cursed beast is gone. We can't catch him.
Idiots! Another mistake!
With slits of eyes guttering cruelly, the old man glared around at the chagrined faces encircling him, his long white beard glowing in the moonlight like a frozen waterfall.
The High Priest will hear of your incompetence. I am certain he will devise a punishment to suit me.
He turned abruptly and started off once more. The guard stood still and watched him.
Bring him.
The guards fell over themselves to obey. Prince Garen was jerked by the arms and dragged along, his feet barely touching the ground as they continued on their way. A pale moon poured molten silver into the bowl of the lake. The water shone hard and black like glass smoked in a fire, and the willow's teardrop leaves sparkled with dew. Above, the sable sky held sparks of diamond stars, tips of light as cold and sharp as ice. Quentin awoke out of a stony sleep and stared uncomprehendingly around him.
Where am I? How have I come to be here?
Then he remembered rowing to the island and walking, then sinking into sleep. Though his mind was a jumble of half-formed thoughts and fragments of unfinished dreams, waking in this place, he felt strangely certain that he had been drawn here, summoned, and then awakened at the proper moment by the same force that had brought him. His senses pricked. The place seemed alive with the presence of gods. If he listened very carefully, he could almost hear the murmur of their spirit voices calling to one another as they plied night's distant shores. Quentin felt the nearness of these beings, and his blood quickened. The gods had gathered close about. They watched from every shadow as from behind velvet curtains, and Quentin imagined their dispassionate eyes upon him. He rose, stiff from his exertion, wrapped his arms across his chest, and gazed out across the lake. Mist rose like steam from the still water, to thicken and drift in curling tendrils toward the crescent lawn like searching fingers. Quentin stepped to the water's edge and waited. The ghostly white mist seeped and flowed and danced on unseen currents in the air, spreading ever nearer. He waited, his stomach taut, the night chill stinging his flesh, the sense of expectancy almost overpowering. Blood pulsed rapidly through his veins. Quentin stood at the edge of the Silver Lake and watched as the shifting vapors erected lacework walls over the mirrored surface. As he gazed out over the water, the mist rolled and parted, and there emerged a dark shape drifting slowly toward him across the lake. Quentin saw that it was a small boat, gliding from the wreathing vapors. No oarsman rowed the vessel, no pilot steered. Wide of hull and low in the water, it drew nearer and came at last to rest at the king's feet. Quentin lifted his foot cautiously and stepped into the mysterious craft, as if he thought that it might vanish into the mist once more. But the boat proved solid enough, and Quentin sat down amidships. Then, just as silently and mysteriously as before, the ghostly vessel floated away from the shore, bearing him back across the lake, the way it had come. Sitting stiffly on the wooden bench, Quentin watched as the ship entered the encircling mist. The solid world faded from view, and he was swallowed whole into a netherworld of cloud and insubstantial vapor. He might have been floating or flying, so softly and gently did the boat ride. Not a ripple marked their passage. Straining eyes into the void, Quentin saw nothing. After a time, the mist thinned and parted, and the little craft drifted out into a shallow lagoon, rimmed with the massive slabs of great standing stones. There was some magic in this place. Quentin could feel it now, tingling over him, licking at his face and limbs with subtle fire. Then he saw the figure. Before him, at the water's edge, stood a man clothed in a long white mantle that glowed in the moon's radiant beams. He beckoned to Quentin to follow, and as the boat touched shore, Quentin stepped out and hastened after the figure. They moved across the lawn to the giant stones, passing between them into a circle of smaller stones, many of them leaning or fallen. These stones, like others Quentin had seen in Mensendor, had once stood one upon another in rings at the worship sites of the ancients. The rings were erected in places of power where gods were said to touch the earth. As they entered the sacred circle of stone, Quentin saw fire burning brightly and meat roasting on spits. The white-clothed figure sat down on one of the tumbled stones, which had grown thick with green moss and white-flecked lichen. The man smiled warmly and gestured for Quentin to sit. Though no words had passed between them, Quentin felt welcomed and unafraid. He watched while the man tended the spits. The stranger was tall, his body well-formed and fit, his features broad, but not coarse or heavy. There was strength in the cut of his jaw and chin. His long dark hair swept back and was bound in a thong at the back of his head in the manner of prophets or seers. The man's eyes were dark, quick firebrands that sparked in the light of the campfire as he adjusted the roasting meat on the fire with his strong hands. The fire threw grotesque shadows over the standing stones. A thousand questions boiled in Quentin's mind, but he remained silent. No word seemed appropriate for this place. So he sat in the warm circle of light and waited. At last, the stranger reached for a nearby jug and poured from it into a wooden cup, which he offered to Quentin.
Are you hungry?
Yes.
Good. I thought you might be hungry, so I fixed you something to eat. It has been a long journey and you've ridden far.
How did you know?
I know a great many things about you.
There was something familiar, hauntingly familiar about the man. His voice and manner, Quentin was certain he had known before. But where? The memory eluded him.
There are many who might make a similar claim. My name is well enough known.
Ah, well said. You are the Dragon King of Mensendor. And truly, many men know your name. But I know a good deal more.
Please, continue.
I know that you're an honorable man whose friends are many, and that you recently lost a friend, one very dear to you. I also know that you stand in danger of losing another even dearer.
Is that all?
It is enough for now, I think. Here, the meat is ready.
The man handed Quentin one of the skewers and kept one, took up his wooden cup and drank. Quentin drank too, and thought he had never tasted water so fresh and good. He pulled a piece of meat from the spit and ate it. all the while watching the stranger beside him.
What is your name?
Well, call me your friend, for friend I am.
Friend? Nothing more?
Yeah, what more is needed?
Where am I, friend? What is this place?
The man didn't answer.
You see these stones?
Yes.
They were erected and stood for many hundreds of years, but now they lie abandoned and overthrown. The gods in whose honor they were raised come no more to this place. Why do you think that is?
Quentin considered this for a moment.
Could it be that the old gods are dying? Or that they never existed in the first place? There are those who say a new era has come upon us, and a new god is making himself known.
What do you say?
I believe that times change, yes. And new eras are born. But there is only one god, who is god of us all. Whether other gods exist or never did, I cannot say.
Strange words from an acolyte.
The stranger's smile was elusive, and suggested he held some greater secret to himself. But Quentin was stunned. It had been a long time since he had been called an acolyte. He had nearly forgotten that he ever served in the temple at all. That seemed long ago.
I was but a boy.
Well, times change, as you say. But old ways die hard, do they not?
Quentin said nothing. The man looked around the ring of fallen stones.
Why do you suppose men honor their gods with stone?
Stone endures.
Yes, but as you see, even stone falls in the end. What is it that endures after stone has crumbled to dust?
Quentin recognized this question as one that his old teacher Yesef, the elder of Dekra, had asked him as a pupil many years ago. Old Yesef, dead now and buried years before.
Man's spirit endures?
That had been the answer Yesef had sought.
And love endures. Would it not make more sense to honor the god with love instead of temples made of stone?
Again, a pang of guilt arrowed the king. Who was this man?
Quentin, do not be afraid.
I am not.
The man raised a hand and cut him off.
And do not give yourself to despair. Your enemies seek to humble you, to mock the god you serve. Trust in the Most High, and he will raise you up.
The man stood and smiled again.
The boat will take you back across the water.
Oh, do not go! Please!
I must. My time here is finished. I wanted to see you just once more and to say farewell.
No!
Quentin threw himself to his knees.
Stay with me. I would hear more.
It's not to be. But never fear. We will be together again. I'm certain of it.
The man smiled his gentle smile and laid a hand on Quentin's head. Quentin felt a rush of warmth flood through him at the touch. The panic that had come upon him ceased.
Before, I did not get the chance to say goodbye as I would have wished.
The man raised Quentin to his feet and wrapped him in a hug.
Goodbye, my friend.
Goodbye.
Quentin watched as the man turned and walked toward the wood, passing between two great slabs of stone as through a doorway. The mist rolled up, and he was gone.